You're listening to The Star Spot, episode 156 for Sunday, November 25th, 2018.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at The Star Spot. One of the challenges in building a future where humans are able to explore other worlds are the massive, clumsy, and expensive spacesuits currently in use. Now enter into the picture Pacific Space Flight. They're a grassroots team with a do-it-yourself attitude, and they're busy perfecting the next generation spacesuit technology. Today we're joined here at The Star Spot by their leader, Professor Cameron Smith, an anthropologist and archaeologist whose research on humanity's deep past now fuels his determination to take us into the future. But first, here's what's current in space. The Star Spot Podcast is now the Star Spot Podcast and Radio Show. That's right, your favorite astronomy program is now traveling through space, specifically the 1280 AM frequency. Our broadcaster, CJRU The Scope at Ryerson, is now available on the radio dial, which means you can join us at The Star Spot at 1280 AM every Sunday 8 PM and Tuesday 6 PM Eastern Time.
A new galaxy right next door to ours has been discovered with some ghostly characteristics. Antlia 2 is a dwarf galaxy, but it has a similar size as our biggest near neighbor, the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's a few times farther than the LMC, but still, doesn't it seem like we should have known that such a galaxy was so nearby? One reason why we didn't find it earlier is that our view of it is blocked by the disk of the Milky Way in what's called the Zone of Avoidance. The other is that it is extremely diffuse, thin and dim, to the point that it has us doubting our current models of galaxy structure and formation. It was discovered using the Gaia Space Telescope, a relatively new mission that is busily observing and cataloging billions of stars. A team, led by Gabriel Torrealba from the Academia Sinica in Taiwan, was using RR Lyrae variable stars as a way to explore our galaxy's local group. These stars are a type of standard candle. The timing of their brightness variations can be directly related to their average power output, and using their actual brightness compared to their observable brightness, we can figure out their distance. These particular variable stars are often found in old, metal-poor environments like dwarf galaxies. Since such galaxies were born long ago in the early universe, there were fewer so-called metals, elements larger than hydrogen and helium. In larger galaxies, those elements are produced by the life and death of many generations of stars. But not only do dwarf galaxies not have the gas to make lots of stars, they are often disrupted or even digested by larger neighbor galaxies. The team was surprised to find Antlia 2, which is very big and yet had never been seen before, but then it is 10,000 times fainter than the similarly sized Large Magellanic Cloud. They've termed it a ghost of a galaxy. Probably it is close enough to the Milky Way that tidal forces have stripped it of much of its gas and mass, and ending its star formation. Its size, however, makes it a mystery, as generally having material removed from something would make it smaller, while instead Antlia 2 might have gotten bigger. Expanding while losing mass has given it an extremely low density. It may have been pushed apart by known phenomena like supernova, but the team has gone so far as to speculate that it may even hint at dark matter properties. Whatever has given Antlia 2 its ghostly properties will certainly want to bust the mystery.
On August 21st, 2017, millions of people in the United States were treated to a spectacle unlike any other, a total solar eclipse. a total solar eclipse occurs when the Sun, Moon, and Earth respectively line up. To an observer on Earth, the Moon's disk would appear to completely cover the Sun, literally turning day into night for a few minutes. The August 2017 eclipse was special in that it was the first since 1979 to cross the entire continental United States. It's therefore no surprise that the millions who watched it applauded, cheered, and screamed with emotion as it washed over them. Clearly, humans were affected by this event. But what about animals? Over a year after this eclipse, new research has revealed how certain critters reacted as it happened. First off, it's important to realize that finding out what wildlife do during a total solar eclipse isn't as easy as it seems, for when the moon's shadow, or umbra, casts itself over a certain region, it becomes dark. But a team of researchers out of Cornell University and the University of Oxford themselves realized that radar would effortlessly punch through the darkness and allow them to determine wildlife behavior not only in one area, but on a country-wide scale. Led by Cecilia Nilsson of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, the researchers used data from 143 weather radar sites across the United States to launch their study. They analyzed airborne wildlife behavior on radar 2 days before and after the eclipse, and then compared this activity with that observed during the eclipse. It turns out that while ordinary airborne behavior during the day decreased, such as foraging for food, typical activity at night did not increase, such as high-altitude migratory patterns. This is fascinating in that the twilight sky brought on by the eclipse curbed wildlife activity. Since it was dark, wildlife should have reacted as if it were night. But there is a possible explanation proposed by Nilsson. As the moon's umbra approached, insects and birds could have become confused, interpreting the oncoming darkness as active weather rolling in, like a thunderstorm. Also, just before an eclipse occurs, not only does the sky darken, but the temperature noticeably drops as well, which is extremely similar to a storm. However, the most remarkable finding made by Nilsson and her team was at 8 of the 143 radar sites, which were within the path of totality. This is the swath of land containing 14 states, from Oregon to South Carolina, where people experience the moon's complete shielding of the sun, called totality, including darkness for a few minutes. Those outside this path would have only seen a partial eclipse. At those 8 sites, the team detected a sudden explosion of activity during totality, perhaps the result of insects or birds leaping into the air as a reaction to the umbra abruptly sweeping over them, even though the team learned that overall, wildlife activity during the eclipse decreased. Published November 14, 2018, in the journal Biology Letters, these findings demonstrate that wildlife are also affected by a total solar eclipse, just differently than we. But they also take home the fact that both forms of life are tied together, that we share the same blue planet. And we'll hopefully be reminded of this again during the next eclipse, on April 8th, 2024. Let the countdown continue.
Ever since the 1960s, human beings have been able to experience space firsthand. However, the properties of space are still widely unknown. We know that space is mostly empty, an imperfect vacuum with bits of particles from stars, heat, radio waves, and other kinds of energy. However, many of its properties, such as some of its effects on human health, are uncertain. In the coming months, thousands of tiny worms will be sent to the International Space Station in a project to study how muscle cells develop both in space and on Earth. Today, we will cover this project and delve into the possibilities that space research can have on healthcare. The issue at hand is that of microgravity. Here on Earth, think of the many things that we do every day to maintain our muscle mass. You might think of strenuous activities like lifting weights or doing bodyweight exercises like push-ups or pull-ups, but the reality is that every little action you do contributes to your muscle mass. This is because your body needs your muscles to be exercised, even in what seems like tiny amounts, in order to maintain them at a basic level. In space, since gravity is so low, there is nothing for your body to push against. Very little effort is required to move around. The result? Muscle atrophy. Astronauts can lose up to a staggering 40% of their muscle mass in a 6-month mission spent in space, as well as 1.5% of their bone mass for every month spent in space. Now come in the worms. 1 millimeter long specimens called C. elegans. As stated before, The government of the UK is backing a project that will send thousands of tiny worms to the International Space Station. Living in a sealed bag with bacterial food, the worms will be subject to the microgravity in space, and then frozen and sent back to Earth for analysis. The purpose behind the project is to use the research to develop solutions for muscle loss in space and on Earth. Muscle loss in space is very similar to how aging people are affected on Earth, as their muscles grow progressively weaker over time, as well as those who suffer from muscular dystrophy and diabetes. The reason that worms will be effective is because their muscular structure is similar to that of humans, as they suffer muscle loss in many of the conditions that humans do. As muscle is a supporting pillar that allows the human body to function, figuring out solutions to this problem will have widespread results. It will have a huge impact on the aging process, improving the quality of life for the elderly, as well as those afflicted with all kinds of conditions. The government of the UK in particular is hoping that by 2035, an average person will be able to live 5 years longer. Hopefully, the research from this project will be able to contribute to this goal. Scientists hope to use the findings in order to help aging people on Earth. Since age-related muscle loss is so inevitable, understanding how it works and figuring out ways to curb it could significantly impact average lifespans around the world. Not only this, but the research will be incredibly important for prolonged missions, such as future colonizations of Mars and the Moon. This is just one example of the possibilities that research in space has opened up for humanity. It is going to be truly exciting to see what scientists will be able to come up with in the near future.
In the core of most, if not all, galaxies are black holes. When galaxies collide, so do their black holes, creating a single supermassive black hole in the center. During these collisions, the black holes rip apart the massive amounts of present matter, thus releasing an enormous quantity of light in the form of X-rays. However, not all studies seem to support the link between merging galaxies and the creation of black holes. One of the main reasons for the lack of evidence is that large portions of gas and dust tend to swirl around during these galactic encounters, obscuring the view of the galactic cores and making it harder to detect the black holes. According to computer simulations, this only heightens during the final stages of a galactic merger. But the growth of a supermassive black hole during this process has been recently observed, leading to the idea that even more massive black holes can be created in such a way. In order to find these elusive black holes, researchers first searched through 10 years' worth of X-ray data from NASA's Neil Gerald Swift Observatory, then through data from NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and the Keck Observatory in Hawaii to find galaxies that match the same output of X-rays. Using computer-controlled deformed mirrors in a process called adaptive optics, the Keck Observatory was able to produce sharper images than ever before, playing a key role in finding these hidden objects. As stated by Michael Koss, an astrophysicist at scientific research company Eureka Scientific in Oakland, California, this new technology is, quote, leading to a huge increase in resolution. It would be like going from 20/200 vision where you are legally blind to 20/20 vision, helping us see galaxies in incredible detail, end quote. Out of the 96 galaxies observed at the Keck Observatory and 385 galaxies from the Hubble Space Telescope, 17% had a pair of black holes at their cores, which means that these galaxies are at the late stages of galactic merging. These findings also match the computer simulations, which show that obscured but active black holes are responsible for the merging of many galaxies. In fact, our own galaxy is currently merging with our neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy, until they eventually result in one galaxy with a supermassive black hole at its core. As Koss states, quote, right now the galaxies are separated by millions of light years, but we're moving toward Andromeda at 250,000 miles per hour, or 400,000 kilometers per hour. In 6 billion years, there will be no Milky Way Galaxy or Andromeda Galaxy. Just one big galaxy, end quote. The adaptive optics technology will hopefully allow for clear images from the next generation of ground-based telescopes, such as the 30-meter telescope, the European Extremely Large Telescope, and the giant Magellan Telescope, as well as the heavily anticipated space-based James Webb Space Telescope, which could provide a better view of merging galaxies and measure the masses, growth rates, and other physical features for each member of the nearby black hole pairs.
And that's what's current in space. Cameron Smith is a professor of anthropology and archaeology at Portland State University, author of the book Emigrating Beyond Earth, Human Adaptation and Space Colonization, and he's founder of the think tank Pacific Space Flight. Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined here at the Star Spot by Dr. Cameron Smith. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here and hopefully answer some questions about spacesuits.
Well, I have to admit, I think you're the first archaeologist that we've had on the show. I understand you're an archaeologist at the Portland State University's Department of Anthropology, so I guess you do a bit of archaeology and anthropology, if I'm understanding that correctly. It is the first time we've had either an archaeologist or an anthropologist on the show, so I've got to ask you right off the bat, have you always been interested in space and space exploration? Did you always kind of want to merge those fields, or is this something that you sort of found yourself getting more interested in throughout your career?
You bet. I'm a prehistorian, so I do the archaeology of ancient peoples. And yes, as a kid, I had a strong interest in space. That was inevitable, almost. I lived in Texas when I was 10 years old with my family. I was 10 years old, and everywhere, this was the early 70s, everywhere there was space, right? Space program was in Texas, and Houston was right there, and so it was a very visible part of my world. And I became hooked. Even my dad would bring home films of the lunar landings. As an educator, he had access to NASA public relations films, and he could check out these 8mm films, set up a projector, and just run it. And he'd just, you know, close the door and walk away, and I'd be watching these films of lunar landings, you know. And so, yes, that was in me from a long time back as a kid. But then for many, many different reasons, I went into actually the opposite direction. I went to the human past instead of the human future. Then another change came in the last 10 years, of course, with privatization of space and many people trying to work on getting into space other than just governments. It suddenly became possible again for me to have something to do with this. And so that's when I took up this sort of challenge of mine, is to build a cheaper, lighter spacesuit.
And we will, you know, dive into that very shortly. But just in terms of connecting the dots, I'm curious how you went from seeing your opportunity to integrate your love of space and space exploration with your background in anthropology and archaeology. And I think one thing that I know you've done a lot of research in is sort of understanding the history of the human species and then maybe extrapolating that into the future. You've written some books, some articles, how we can take lessons from anthropology and understand them in the context of space exploration and colonization. And I'm referring to one book in particular, Emigrating Beyond Earth, Human Adaptation and Space Colonization. Can you just help us understand, just in broad strokes, how we can learn the lessons of our deep past, and how we can maybe use some of that insight into where we're going with our future in space?
You bet. I'm so glad you asked. And I'm glad you asked, because there is a depth to, we'll get to the spacesuit in a moment, as you said, but there is a depth to this project, the spacesuit, that is oftentimes invisible when people come and shoot a short video or shoot some photos and we do our normal media. And they're typically focused on the spacesuit as a thing to get into space and then come back to Earth. With anthropology and the lessons of evolution, I'm more interested in a long-term human future in space, a settlement of space, and that means having reproductive and political and material independence from Earth. And what that means is effective space settlements. And that's evolution. That is adaptation to a new environment. So in this field, academically, I'm working on what lessons can we learn from the world of evolutionary biology that can make more successful the attempt to settle space. So we see today Elon Musk has plans for colonization of Mars, and I think that's great, and I think it must be done, should be done. To do it effectively, to ensure that it works well, I think we can learn a lot from the evolutionary processes of what are called range extension or species dispersal. There are good lessons from the world of biology, and I'm trying to cull those from the world of evolutionary biology and apply to the human project.
And I note that you've done some consultation work with SpaceX. I was going to ask you about that a little bit later, but since you mentioned Elon Musk, let me ask you that right now. How much is SpaceX, as an example of a private company which is really at the frontier of private company involvement in space exploration, how much are they considering the kind of work and the kind of research that you've done from an anthropological or archaeological perspective?
Well, they are. It's very closed. I was there in 2014, and I was mind melted by my experiences there, talking with their engineers, and I was just there briefly when they were starting their spacesuit unit, and of course now they've released their designs for their spacesuit, or at least they've released pictures of their first suit.
Yep.
And I was there in a. You know, they are a fascinating thing. Much, I think, rests on the success of SpaceX. You know, since I was a kid, it's been now 40 years of NASA saying we'll be on Mars, you know, in the next few years, the next 10 years. I have no faith in that, I'm afraid. I'm a big fan of NASA. I think they do incredible things, and they have a great many very great people. But they are a big federal organization, and they are very slow to move ahead on Mars. Anyway, with SpaceX, you know, I don't know how carefully they track what I do. Since I worked there briefly, I just haven't had contact with them anymore. I do note that Elon Musk repeatedly says that this is a project to make humanity multiplanetary, and that's a good, I think that's a good short message, a short encapsulation. There's a good reason to be multiplanetary, which is that all life forms face extinction. If you look at the marine species in the last half billion years, 99% of life on Earth has become extinct through one mechanism or another.
Yeah.
It simply makes sense. We buy insurance for our individual lives. Why not insurance for these species?
And as your contribution to becoming a multi-world species, you founded a company called Pacific Spaceflight. So tell me a little bit, or a think tank, I think is how you describe it, but tell me a little bit about this think tank, this company, which has its foot in the door of private space exploration.
You bet. It's not a company. It's I used the words think tank because I couldn't come up with anything else. It is a group of people, and we work on these different projects. Some of it is sort of the umbrella for a number of projects, three scales, essentially. One is the spacesuit, which is a piece of hardware, practical hardware, that I'm trying to make cheaper and lighter. You know that mass to orbit is cost, and right now it's about $10,000 per pound or half kilo to orbit by NASA, $4,000 by SpaceX. So if you can knock off 1 pound, you're saving $6,000 right there. So making it cheaper is always a project. That is one layer of Pacific Spaceflight. Another one is research on technologies that will be useful for Mars. And I've published on this a design for a vehicle exploration of Mars. And it's a very practical design. And so, okay, that was the second layer, Mars. And the third one is my research on this multi-generational species adaptation, human adaptation to environments beyond Earth for, again, species survival, species insurance. So I have these multiple research projects that are all under the umbrella of Pacific Spaceflight.
With respect to the spacesuits in particular, what were some of your design goals in terms of looking at what had been state of the art in terms of, I guess, the NASA spacesuits from previous NASA human spaceflight missions? What was it that you wanted to prioritize to improve on those designs?
Mostly, I wanted to reduce the complexity. There is what I call the holy relic paradigm about spacesuits, which is that they're very delicate and very special, and only one or two people can touch them.
Right.
And I'm trying to get away from that. I'm trying to make a spacesuit. My analogy for it is the 1980s Ford pickup, which it never breaks down. It's very cheap and reliable. And if it breaks down, you can open the hood and you can fix it, right? This is before everything became controlled by chips and electronic. And today, of course, you can't fix your own vehicle. So I wanted the paradigm to go towards something cheap and reliable. Imagine you live on Mars. Your spacesuit is not something that you know, if you have a problem with it, you can call a technician and have them come, you know, 500 million miles and fix your suit at a high cost. No, these have to be very field maintainable, very reliable, and very simple. That's been my main goal, has been to simplify these things.
So you've had a design which has undergone various iterations, and I know that each iteration has been tested very rigorously through some very interesting and exciting tests that you've subjected it to. And let's start with the tests. Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of a beating you have put these suits to?
Sometimes it literally is beating. Like, one segment, and take a mallet or my hand, and I'll beat on it. And I want this is a burst test, and you want to blow things up. You want to find where they fit, right? Where is the weakest point? So we do burst tests. We had Ben Wilson, one of our group members here, about a year ago, and we put him in the suit, and we just cranked the pressure up until something blew up. And we want to do this because we want to find, again, this shows you the weaknesses, right?
What was it that blew up first? I'm curious.
There was a connection between the helmet. So you see the helmets we have, and they connect to the soft textile, right, of the suit.
Yeah.
And this is done by hose clamps and cables, all kinds of methods. And one of those cables slipped, basically. It wasn't tightened enough. It slipped, and the helmet then came away from the neck area, leaving a sort of 3-inch, you know, 10-centimeter gap at the neck. The air instantly flooded out. This would have been instantly lethal on, for example, Mars. So one of the things we do, yes, is these burst tests where we push it to extremely high pressure and we find out where it fails. That tells us where to, you know, focus our efforts on making it stronger.
And you've also done some skydiving. I think it's called a skydiving stability test. That one certainly piqued my interest. Tell me about that.
Well, this is in one of these sort of vertical wind tunnels that skydivers use to simulate, right, skydiving. And this was a few years ago. This was to help us. We were working with Copenhagen Suborbitals, who were going to privately put a human into space. That's still their goal. And the idea was that if they had to bail out, they were going to wear this suit, and if they had to bail out on the descent, let's say, and they had to free fall for a couple of minutes, was the suit in any way suitable for that, right? Or would you just go into an instant tumble because of the geometry of the suit and the wind flow, right, that's going past it as you're falling? And it worked, actually. It turned out to be very stable, but that was important to know. A lot of these are, they sound very simple, you know, can you fall in a stable position? Will it blow up if you bang on it? But those are important to know. They sound crude, but they are important.
You also did an underwater leak detection, and I guess maybe this is a naive question, but when would an astronaut be underwater? Why would that be important?
Well, it was more, there are a number of reasons to do these underwater tests. We've done about 4, and they're very exciting because you really are testing the suit. You're in this thing, you're underwater. It gives you a psychological separation from your crew. And Yes, we look. We one reason to go underwater is to find the tiniest leaks. When you see a stream of bubbles, tiny, tiny bubbles, but if you see a stream of bubbles coming off the suit at a joint seam or something, you know it's leaking. And sometimes those are hard to find at home. If they're tiny leaks, even if I close up all the windows and it's very quiet and I spray it with soapy water, sometimes I can't find the tiniest leak. And going underwater is one reason to do that.
Got it.
Another reason to go underwater, again, psychologically, it separates me from my group. And we're talking on the radio, but, you know, there's a little bit of separation there. That's important to get used to because we're going to be flying these in balloons. And I wanted to get my crew into the psychology of a person. You're communicating with them. You are telling them about what's going on in the suit, but you cannot help them. And in the suit, they cannot help me. It's as though they're on the ground, right, 50,000 feet below me. And we all need to get into this world in which the breathing gas supply is not infinite. We always breathe from scuba tanks, for example. I don't use pumps because I want us always to be aware that we are breathing a consumable and we have a limited time.
Right.
So going underwater had all of those functions. It was important from a perspective of learning how to do those operations, but also finding the tiniest leaks.
Well, I wanted to ask you what kind of overall lessons you learned as you perform these tests on the various iterations of the suit model. Maybe we can actually start with the psychological lessons. Anything surprising there?
Well, I call it a five sensory experience. The aromas that are coming in are different, right? Because you're breathing oxygen from a cylinder. So you're aware of that. I'm rather hyper vigilant, right? You don't want anything to go wrong. Mm-hmm. So you're aware of everything. Touch. Oh, okay. The inside of my gloves has this kind of a feel. And when I grab a pair of pliers, oh, it has this feel. Hearing. Well, we have to set up the microphones inside so you can hear properly, but they're not blasting in your ear too loud. The lesson here is that the person wearing one of these should be experienced in it. You need some time to get up to speed and feel comfortable in it. And then you can actually function and do things. I find that when I put a rookie, a person who's never worn the suit, into the suit and pressurize it, it's a shocking experience for them. And I had forgotten that because I've been in hundreds of times. But people can become sort of paralyzed by all of these new sensations. And I'll say, you know, okay, let's try to bend your arm at the elbow. Let's try to do some push-ups, jump up and down. And sometimes people are paralyzed, and they think they can't do those things because this is so unusual. But after they have hours and hours of experience, they learn how to work with the limitations of the suit, and then they can bend their arm. They can do jumping jacks. They can push-ups because they're no longer in the shock, right? So psychologically, this is a big part of these things.
And I understand one of the ultimate goals with this line of research is to increase the mobility of the astronaut. Can you comment on how successful you were in that respect?
You bet. The history of our project has followed the history of spacesuit development. Number one was making sure that they don't leak. Well, that took me a couple of years to kill all the leaks. Number two was don't let carbon dioxide build up in the suit, so we have to ventilate it properly and keep it nice and cool, and we did that second. Then came, and we're still on it, mobility. And this is the difficult part for all spacesuits. Mobility is difficult because as the suit is pressurized, it becomes rigid. And so you have to do certain things to the fabric, to the textiles that you're working with, to give you a mobility. And we have very good mobility right now and with our suit. And I'm working towards a Mars suit so that you could wear it on the surface of Mars for exploration. We want to be able to climb in that suit. We go out to the crags near here in Portland, and we pressurize the suit, and we climb around on the rocks. In fact, I think Climbing Magazine is about to do a story on this. We want to demonstrate that these things, you know, it's not just for being strapped into the seat of a rocket. These are also going to be for exploration of the surface of Mars. And so mobility is key there. You have to be able to, the whole reason to send people to Mars is they're more agile than robots. these robots are incredible. They're great, but they go, you know, a few meters a day, and they can't sort of turn on a dime. A human, if you've ever been in the field with a geologist, you know that instantly the first thing they do is they're always getting down on their knees and they pick up a little rock and they're looking at it carefully. We need a spacesuit that allows you to do that without any problems, without any effort. So mobility, yeah, it's a big issue now.
There is this perennial debate about whether we should send robots versus humans, and I'm guessing from what you just said and your line of work that you're a big fan of this idea that humans can do things that robots really just are not ever going to be suited to doing. What would be some of those tasks that you think, you know, even technological limitations aside, you want to have a human on Mars to do that kind of exploration?
Well, right away, I think of fossils, and you know, a lot of fossils in Canada, in the Rockies, they're very important fossil beds where you pick up a piece of this rock and you strike it with a hammer and it splits open, and there's a fossilized fern, right? One of the early life forms that colonized land from the sea, mm-hmm. 500 million years ago. And you open that, you break that rock open and you see the fossil. Well, in many it's very likely, I think, that we'll find fossil life or traces of life on Mars in fossils. And it's just a lot easier for a human being to, you know, crouch down, break open the rock with a hammer and look at it. It can always be said that a robot is cheaper. It is. It is safer. Of course, it is safer. Nobody's hurt if the robot fails. But it is less interesting from the human perspective. The whole world of robotics is alien to me. I grew up with the conception that we put humans into danger for exploration. We put humans into these worlds, and we don't rely on the robots to do it. You know, these are two, not necessarily opposing tracks or paths, mm-hmm. But I value the human experience more so, and I love the Mars robots. I think we learn a lot from them. I also believe we must send people. We must send people because they're more agile. They can think more quickly. They can make connections between things that they see in the field right away and do something about that, whereas a robot is this very slow learner.
Right, and maybe there's a reason why on Earth we prefer to have human archaeologists than robot replacements. So how close are we to having, in your opinion, humans ready, maybe technologically, if not psychologically, for the rigors of, let's say, Mars exploration? Looking in particular at the suit, do you think that the suit is just about ready for prime time, or can you project how much longer you know researchers like yourself would need to perfect the design?
Oh boy, the more people we have doing it, the better, because you can never be ready enough, right? Something as dangerous I'll just say that something as dangerous as going to Mars and exploring the surface and having your suit fail, you know, which is pretty much going to be lethal. In the movies, they have a hole in the suit and they put a patch on it, right? Actually, as it turns out, you can't find the leak typically. You hear a hiss, but you don't know where it is. Anyway, it's very dangerous business, and the more people we have working on it right now, the better, because more brains, more minds working on it are going to come up with better or more ideas, and the greater the chances are that one of those is going to be a really great idea. Are we ready for it? No, I don't think anybody has a suit that's ready for Mars. We have some that are probably pretty close to ready, but I think that in North Dakota, at the University of North Dakota, they're building a really great one. NASA has released a few images of some kind of a new suit, but they're pulled in so many different directions, it's hard to know what to do with that thing. So I don't think we have a suit ready, and I'm working on it 24/7 to give us some options. You know, nobody's going to wear the suit that I build here on Mars, but what will happen, hopefully, is that this will stimulate further development. But I'm rather, I guess you would say I'm reckless. I would say let's go almost when we're not ready. Let's go now and get rolling with this. Go with suits that we have and and take the big risks. If we wait until everything is perfectly safe, we'll never do it, mm-hmm. I think. So I think that, you know, are we ready? No. Can we be ready soon? Yes. Should we have everything perfect before we go and reduce risk to zero? No, that'll never happen. So we must take big risks.
Just in our last few minutes, I'm wondering if I can ask the question, are we ready culturally? Because you've done some work in a field called space anthropology, where you've looked, and this is kind of circling back to where we started, and I'm hoping we can kind of end on a similar discussion, because I'm really intrigued by what you have to say about looking at evolution for this concept of adaptation, and in particular looking at cultural evolution and what we can learn from cultural evolution that's relevant towards space settlement and long-duration missions. I know you've written a lot about that. We don't have a lot of time, unfortunately, but I'm hoping you can kind of summarize for me what are some of the insights that are relevant here that might tell us whether or not we're ready, and if we're not ready, what we need to do to get ready as a species for multi-generational efforts to settle a planet like Mars.
You bet. The idea is, you know, can we culturally and psychologically get to a new world, Mars, for example, and settle there and live out our lives? And some of the adaptation culturally is simply accepting the fact that it is a big change. Many cultures are very conservative. They don't like change. You know, I've been listening recently to a lot of old science fiction stories from the 1950s on the radio, these old radio plays. And so many of them have the theme that, oh, if we go to Mars, you know, suddenly we're going to have new words and new vocabulary, and suddenly we're going to become Martians, very different from Earth, and this is a big problem. I see it totally differently. Of course we should become Martians. Why should we expect to carry everything of, you know, suburban American life or Canadian life to Mars, and everything is going to be the same? Of course not. So simply, being ready for change, knowing that human culture has to change, language, even gestures, bodily gestures. Imagine body language, which is such a big component of communication, in one-third gravity, right, as we have on Mars, versus on Earth. Even our gestures then will change. So I would say one big important lesson from evolution, cultural evolution, is expect us to change and don't fight it. We're going to be different people on a different world.
And in fact, over, you know, maybe thousands of years or tens of thousands of years, of course, we have changed culturally. If you look at just linguistic change alone, you can even see that within a few hundred years that languages can change quite profoundly. There's the area of migration that I wanted to get into too, because of course the idea of migrating to another planet has a precedent to some extent in human migrations across the continents or across the oceans. What can we learn about migration patterns and how culture has changed as a result of human migrations? Is there anything relevant from that history?
Well, that's what I'm working on. That's what I'm looking at, is how has this happened? How has it played out in the past? It has a bad past here on Earth because you had Europeans coming out of Europe and encountering North and South America, the New World, in the 1500s.
Yeah.
And there were tens of millions of native people here, and it was a very bad interaction for them. Tens of millions of people died as a result of this.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, the concept, the words space colonization, this has a what's called a high yuck factor. Instantly the term colonization is associated with bad things. Again, because it has this bad history on Earth. I'm not trying to downplay that bad history. But it is very different on Mars. There isn't anyone there. And so settling that place will be radically different. There are a couple of interesting parallels, but it really will be a new thing. And imagine, you know, you go there, you have a family or multiple families going there, and there is an entire planet to explore. There are landscapes that people will name, just as people on Earth give names to points on landscapes, that sort of thing. I think very exciting, very exciting for a thing for families to do. I work alone on this, well, not alone, but I work on this project. It's largely something I do myself, and I don't have a wife and kids, and so I'm actually not the right person to do, for example, Mars colonization. I'm for Mars exploration. I'd go tomorrow. But for settlement, for colonizing a new place, to have viable communities of people beyond Earth, that's a different thing, and it just hasn't been done. So I'm working on, I'm doing the research of looking at the human past with regard to these kind of things, and you know, seeing what sort of lessons can we learn. But I don't have those assembled for you just yet, I'm afraid.
I just have one last question. I think you're the right guy to ask this to, because you've studied human history, and now, of course, you're involved in contributing to where we're going with, as a species, into our future. You've also commented on, to some extent, on your thoughts about SpaceX and NASA. You see reasons for optimism and also some areas to be concerned about. Are you generally an optimistic or a pessimistic person when it comes to space exploration? Do you see us getting off of this planet? It's just kind of a matter of when, or is there a real chance that it might never happen, and that's why you're so motivated to contribute what you can to it?
I'm extremely optimistic. Oftentimes, when you talk about space settlement and putting humans into space, it is a very divisive issue. People either tend to love it or hate it. People who love it, okay, they're already on, they're on board with my ideas. So, but people who hate it have, I believe, some serious misconceptions about what is implied by the term space settlement. For example, people think that we're going to abandon the Earth, and that would be irresponsible. I agree. It would be irresponsible to burn out a planet and move to another one. But that nobody has ever proposed that we are going to abandon the Earth and move everybody to a new planet. This is a backup. This is a backup to civilization. It's just like backing up your hard drive or buying insurance. And putting people on Mars gives humanity a chance in the event that some terrible catastrophe happens here on Earth. But we must solve the terrible problems we have on Earth. Another idea or misconception is that this will take everything we have, it will take all the resources we've got, all the money and everything that we've got, and those should be, in fact, used to solve our problems on Earth. And I totally agree, we have to solve these problems, I just mentioned that, on Earth, but it doesn't take everything to settle a new world. Again, SpaceX has modest plans, privately developed plans, essentially, to go there, and it won't break the bank or won't prevent us from, the bulk of humanity who will remain on Earth from solving our problems here. Another big misconception is that our earthly problems can be solved with money. We have been pouring money into solving Earth problems many times for generations, and they don't get solved. And maybe there are other solutions to our Earth problems than just funneling money at them. So I think that when people have a rejection, immediate, it's very common. It's a sort of knee-jerk rejection. How can you go to, propose going to settle a new planet when we have so many terrible problems on Mars, on Earth? If you take that apart and examine that a little bit more carefully, I think that's typically said out of, they're genuine. They have genuine concerns, and I think they're right, but I think it's based on some misconceptions about what's being proposed.
Cameron Smith, I really appreciate you joining us here on the Star Spot. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot. Mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li, marketing and promotions by Natalie Morcos, guest hosting by Denise Fong, news production by Benjamin Jenkins, news contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan. Web design by Blair Renault, graphics by Carmina Svillens, and I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.